Can I welcome you all for the annual globalization panel at the London School of Economics? It's sort of like Groundhog Day. We start a new year with another globalization debate. The title is the same, the views change, and we have different views on globalization every year. Mine changes all the time. Anyway, I'm Meghnad Desai. I'm chairing this meeting. I'm professor of economics here and director of the Center for Study of Global Governance. The four speakers that you're going to listen to are Tony Giddens, the director of the London School of Economics and a master sociologist who has written many, many books. And if you can afford to buy all of them, you clearly will need another loan from the bank. Mary Caldor, who is a professor of politics at the London School of Economics, and she is director of the Global Civil Society Program in the Center for the Study of Global Governance. John Gray, who is a professor at the European Institute. I think he's a professor of European philosophy or European thought, I forget what, but he's a master of basically thought across the centuries and has written a very exciting book lately on, among other things, animal rights, globalization, and other things. Lastly is David Held, who's a professor of politics and again, an author of many, many books. Many of the books are on sale outside, and since they're a very small selection of the many books your panel have written, and because it includes the book that I have written, do buy them. Each speaker will have 15 minutes, and after that, we will take questions not statements or speeches, and so they'll be short. And in the meantime, if you people feel inspired to ask questions in a written form, please write them down and pass them along by some osmotic process. We can receive them here, and then I will read them out, and the panel will try to answer them. Our first speaker is Tony Giddens, who I think invented globalization single-handedly in some small room in Cambridge University. That tells you what idle academics do. Your mic isn't working.
You have to come sit down, I think.
No.
One minute.
Sorry about that. He sabotaged you.
No.
Ah, that's more like it.
Well, there we go. Let me add my welcome to that of Meghnad, and I'd like especially to welcome all the new LSE students who might be here today, and I hope you all have a wonderful time studying at the LSE. Meghnad mentioned this was a sort of Groundhog Day event. That is, this is a replay of an event we did last year because so many people wanted to come and couldn't get in that we thought we'd do it again, but it's not completely Groundhog Day because I presume there are lots of people here who weren't at the LSE before and therefore couldn't have heard it last year. Can I try just a little experiment on you? How many people here come from Africa or the Middle East? How many people here come from Asia or Australasia? Plenty. How many people come from Europe, including the UK? How many people come from the Americas, North and South? Well, there you are then, sort of slanted a bit towards Europe, but LSE is an example of globalization because if I asked you more specific questions, there are students here from 150 countries. LSE is not obviously a wholly representative global community, but it is a global community nevertheless. So it's an example, in a way, of what we're discussing here this evening. I'd like to begin by proposing to you that the debate about globalization is the single most important debate going on in the social sciences and in politics today. The reason for that is that it's a debate about what shape our world will assume. It's a debate about what are the major forces moving our societies, And it's fundamentally a debate about how we respond. It's fundamentally a debate about what kind of policy issues we should endorse to make the world a better place than it is at the moment. Now, David Held, sitting on the platform there, has aptly said that the what he calls the great globalization debate has gone through two phases. First phase was a purely academic phase that began in the mid-1980s and ended somewhere in the mid-1990s. The first phase of the globalization debate was an intellectual affair, and it was a debate about whether globalization exists at all. There are many people who thought, well, there's a lot of talk about the term globalization, but maybe not much has changed. Many people said, well, look, you've had global empires before, haven't you? You've had the Chinese Empire, you had Middle Eastern empires. In the late 19th century, you had a big expansion of world markets, didn't you? There was a lot of currency exchange, financial markets grew in the late 19th century. So people ask, well, is there a reality here? Well, the first phase of the great globalization debate is over. It's over because we've had so much effective work on what globalization means to us today. And the result of that debate, I think, is definitively to show that we are the first citizens of something like a truly global age, that this is, although it has parallels with what happened before, it's in many respects quite different. The current age of globalization is much more intense. It's much more dynamic. It's much more profound in its consequences than anything that has ever gone before, no matter how far there might be analogies with previous periods of history. So we're now into the second phase of the great globalization debate. This is very different from the first. The first phase, as I mentioned, was an intellectual affair. Well, I suppose this is an intellectual affair, but the second phase of the great globalization debate has brought people out into the streets. It's associated with the rise of the so-called anti-globalization movement. It's associated with mass demonstrations in the streets, beginning in the meetings of the WTO in Seattle a few years ago, and happening in more than 100 cities across the world since then. The term globalization has become politicized, and the term globalization has entered into the actual political field itself. Now, I'd like to say briefly in my quarter of an hour what I think the demonstrators are doing there and what the implications of their actions are for the wider political community. But let me just say a few things about my take before that on the globalization debate, what globalization means, how we should conceptualize it. I think that both sides in the second phase of the great globalization debate tend to misconstrue what globalization is. That is to say, they both tend to interpret globalization primarily as an economic phenomenon. They both identify it mainly with the spread of global marketplace and with the increasing intensity of the role of financial institutions. Now, in this, they're certainly not completely wrong. There is, or have been, major advances in the integration of the world economy, although it still remains heavily regionalized. Certainly, financial and currency markets are massively important than they were 20 or 30 years ago. These changes are real, but to me, they don't really express the fundamental aspects of what is transforming the world. To me, globalization is not just economic. It's also political, it's also cultural, and it's driven more than anything else by the impact of communications. I think you can even date the time at which we entered the new global age. I would put it late 1960s, early 1970s, because that was the first time at which an effective satellite system was sent up above the world, making possible communication from any part of the world to any other part of the world. Excuse me. Once you have instantaneous communication, so many other things change in the global society. The very changes one sees in financial markets would not be possible without the impact of the communications revolution, or more accurately put, the marriage between communications and computers, which has so transformed so many aspects of our lives. Globalization is political because it's transforming sovereignty. Many people will tell you the nation state is disappearing, but I don't think this is true at all. I think you could make the opposite argument. You could say that this is the period of the high point of the nation-state, because this is the first time at which the nation-state has become a universal form. In all previous ages, nations existed alongside empires and other political formations, and you could say the Soviet Empire was the last example of an imperial formation. Now every state is a nation-state or a state-nation or attempting to become a nation-state. Some are not doing it at all well, but every society in the world is or aspires to become a nation-state of some form. But as the nation-state becomes universalized, it changes its nature. The sociologist Daniel Bell put it in this very famous way, justly repeated many, many times, when he said the nation-state in the global era becomes too small to solve the big problems, but it's too big to solve the small problems. It doesn't mean the nations disappear. It doesn't mean that political power becomes unimportant. It doesn't mean, and this is crucial, that government becomes unimportant. Government is still central, democratic government, not just at a national level, but hopefully stretching above it and below it, is just as important, or maybe more important, than it was before. But nations become transformed. Every nation in the world, more or less, has a crisis of identity, and that's because every nation is looking at its past, looking for its future, realizes that new forms of collaboration are necessary. Well, at least everywhere except the United States seem to recognize that new forms of collaboration are necessary in the global era. So nations are becoming transformed, but they're not disappearing. And politicians still remain major agents in the contemporary world. If I were to sum up what globalization means, I would say two things by it. You can have a simple definition, easy definition. In the easy definition, globalization simply means increasing interdependence. We are more interdependent with one another in many ways across the world, rich and poor, middle class, working class, upper class, than we ever were before. But a more profound and sociological definition would argue that globalization, which has many different causes, or several different causes, and a multiplicity of outcomes, is a sort of institutional transformation. To me, going through all of our major institutions, beginning with a family, going through economic life, going through the nature of the state, as I mentioned, and going to transnational institutions too. Now, people are in the streets protesting against it. What is the logic of their protest, and should those who are not participating listen to them? Yes, they absolutely should listen to them. I think there are three main moral imperatives which are driving what used to be called the anti-globalization movement, and now I think quite fruitfully tends to call itself the movement for global social justice. First of all, the movement argues that globalization is essentially an affair of the West, an affair of the richer nations, from which the poorer nations do not gain enough. It's an affair of 1 billion people in the more affluent sectors of the world, four-fifths the rest of the world remain excluded from it. Is this argument accurate? Well, you must judge. My answer very briefly in a quarter of an hour talk would be, yes, in some respects it is obviously the case, but in other respects it is not, and therefore if you overgeneralize it, you don't really understand what it means to live in a more interdependent world. We need a much more level playing field, much more level playing field between the poorer countries and the richer countries, no doubt about it. But to say that globalization is simply a Western project, to me, makes very little sense, and I imagine one or two of the panelists might possibly, I don't know, disagree with that. Second, the second thing the protesters are saying is that corporations have too much power in our lives. Is this true? Again, I think you'd have to say, yes, but. It is certainly true in some ways, I think. A good society is not a society which is too much invaded by markets. If you have a society which is too dominated by markets and too dominated by oligopolistic corporations that can dominate markets, you get too much insecurity, you get too much commercialism. Commercialism can drive out human values in a society. There is a real issue of recovering the public sphere. There is a real issue of recovering public institutions. There is a real issue, a range of issues, as we know, around corporate regulation. But just like the first argument, if you push it too far, it becomes self-negating and you do not have an accurate picture of what the world is like. Corporations do have a lot of power, especially the big ones, But nations have much more power, especially when they act collaboratively. And states have done far, far, far worse things to their populations than corporations could ever possibly do. States have murdered millions of people in the 20th century and before. So we certainly should fear the state, or at least some types of state, I think much more than we should corporations, even though there is a need for the regulation of corporate power. Third, the protesters are saying the world is too unequal, and they attribute this inequality to globalization. The world is too unequal. You cannot argue with that. There are massive inequalities in world society. No one knows whether inequalities in the global society are getting worse or not. Those who specialize in the analysis of economic inequality are strictly divided about it. There isn't a clear consensus among economists about whether or not inequality is increasing, but we do know that regional inequalities have increased a lot. We do know that Africa bears the burden of many of the worst tensions in world society. We do know that if you look at Latin America, the level of inequality in Latin America has not gone down over the past 20 to 30 years. That the era, if you like, of opening up to free markets has not produced more equal societies in Latin America. Although, of course, Asia has become more equal to the West because it's enjoyed much faster growth processes than Western countries have. The key point is, are these things the result of globalization? And would a retreat from globalization help to produce a more equal world or not? I can only say my opinion very briefly, given my 1.5 minutes left. My view is that many of the things which now people blame on the term globalization, which has become a kind of, to some extent, a bit of an empty term in political discourse, are the result of the previous era. They're a result of the Cold War era. They're a result of the divisions of a bipolar world. This is true of some of the worst problems of Africa, the worst problems of Central America and elsewhere. You cannot blame the more recent global age for all of these strains and tensions, which were part of the world when the world was manipulated by two superpowers who fought out their proxy wars in different parts of the globe. And what happened in Afghanistan is such a poignant example, really, of that, because the Americans originally actively encouraged the very fundamentalist groups which later turned on them. Is globalization the remedy, or is it the problem? It is neither. We must have more effective globalization in the future. You cannot equate globalization with the expansion of markets, as I said. It is ridiculous, I think, to suppose that a poorer country, which has, for example, a corrupt government, ineffective civil society, is going to be anything more than an open economy with corrupt government and an ineffective civil society if you open out to the wider marketplace. You must, therefore, have institutional transformation. You must attempt to produce more effective democratization in poorer countries. The rich countries must aid the poorer countries in this process. But I think it is possible to create a better world. It is possible to create a more effective form of globalization. And that's what we should have as our task for the next 10 to 20 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. That's a very good link up to David Held, who has just published a book on governing globalization, as well as a book on globalization and anti-globalization. You may also have read his book, Global Transformation, which is a big and kind of comprehensive text on globalization. David.
Thank you. I'll organize my remarks, I think, in a manner quite complementary to those you've just heard. But I'm going to focus on a number of core challenges posed by globalization. And the title really is Five Challenges, One Possible Solution. So let me begin by stressing, as Tony Higgins has already done, that there's nothing new about globalization. There have been many phases of globalization after the last two millennia. If you think about the development of world religions, the spread of Christianity and Islam, the age of discovery, and the spread of empires. It always amazes me that in this country today we can't run a railway system, but you know, Oxbridge and a few related institutions ran one of the biggest empires the world has ever seen. But having said this, having acknowledged that there have been previous forms, historical forms of globalization, it's important to note, I think, that there's something new about globalization today. And what is new is the confluence of change across human activities, economic, political, legal, communicative, and environmental. It's this extraordinary intermeshing of change across all these domains, driven by some of the forces we've just been talking about or hearing about. And the result is all too familiar. It's the emergence of a global economy, 24-hour trading in financial markets, multinational companies which dwarf many a country, new forms of international law, the development of regional and global governance structures, and, I think for the first time historically, the creation of truly global, systemic, interconnected problems. These are global warming, AIDS, mass terrorism, market volatility, exploding global inequalities, things like money laundering, the international drugs trade, the difficulties and challenges of regulating genetic engineering, and so on. And I think a number of striking challenges are posed by these global systemic problems, and I want to just mention five. First, clearly, and I think obviously enough, contemporary processes of globalization create overlapping networks of power which cut across territorial boundaries. As such, they put pressure on and strain a world order designed in accordance with the Westphalian principle of exclusive sovereign rule over a bounded territory. That is to say, there's increasingly a mismatch between the political order based on states and the extensive processes and networks, social, economic, environmental, communicative, and so on, which cut across borders. Second, the locus of effective political power can no longer be assumed to be simply national governments or national states, because effective power is shared, bartered, contested by diverse forces and agencies, public and private, at national, regional, and international levels. We are, as Kant most elegantly put it nearly over 200 years ago, unavoidably side by side. Increasingly, the fortunes of nations are enmeshed together. Yet, even though we're unavoidably side by side, we live in a world where powerful decisions, where powerful states make decisions not just for their peoples, but for others as well, and where transnational forces cut across the boundaries of national communities in diverse ways. And in this world, the question of who should be accountable to whom and on what basis do not easily resolve themselves. Because since the early modern period, most political theory has answered that question by assuming the integrity and the core nature of the state. The political good inheres in the state. But if powerful decisions make decisions not just for their citizens, but for others as well, and if transnational forces cut across boundaries, what is the proper constituency? Who should be accountable to whom and on what basis? Tricky new political questions, I think. The third set of challenges, I think, are as follows. Existing political institutions, national and international, are weakened by three crucial regulatory and political gaps. Firstly, a jurisdictional gap. That is the discrepancy between a globalized world and national separate units of policymaking, giving rise to the problem of externalities, such as environmental degradation, and who is responsible for them. Witness the weakness of the international community faced with the Kyoto renegade. Secondly, there's a participation gap, the failure of the existing system to give adequate voice to many leading global actors, not just state, but also non-state actors. And finally, I think there's an incentive gap, the challenges posed by the fact that in the absence of any supranational entity to regulate the supply and use of global public goods, many states will simply seek to free ride or fail to have any incentives to provide durable solutions to pressing transnational problems. And this relates to a fourth gap. It seems to me that these three political disjunctures I've listed are connected to an additional gap, what we can call simply, for argument's sake, a moral gap. That's a gap defined by a world in which over 1.2 billion people live on less than a dollar a day, 46% of the world's population live on less than $2 a day, and 20% of the world's population enjoy over 80% of its income. And related to this, I think, are commitments and values of, at best, passive indifference to this, marked by UN expenditure per annum of 1.25 billion. Remember that. UN per annum expenditure. This is minus peacekeeping, but the broad budget, 1.25 billion. Right. What's the US confectionery expenditure per annum? Any bids? Well, it's obviously more than 1.25 billion. The US per annum confectionery expenditure is 27 billion. Right. US per annum alcohol expenditure. Any bids more? Well, it's obviously up from that. It's 70 billion per annum. And the US per annum expenditure on cars, through the roof, 550 billion. And actually, these figures would be much higher because they come from 2 or 3 years ago. So, plus inflation, other increases of demand, they'd be even higher. This is not an anti-American statement, because equivalent EU figures could have been taken. There's a lovely EU-American figure that I like. If you add up the amount of money spent on pet food in the EU and in America, it's 17 billion per annum. The UN budget, 1.25 billion. Okay, that global inequalities spark conflict is hardly a surprise, especially given the visibility today of the world's lifestyles in an age of mass communications and the mass media. Fifth and finally of my challenges, there's been a shift, it seems to me, from a relatively discrete set of national communication and economic systems to, as Tony has suggested, their more complex and diverse enmeshment at regional and global levels. And there's been a shift from government to multi-level governance. But, and here's the rub, here's the problem, there are few grounds for thinking that a parallel globalization of political identities has taken place, except among the elites of the global order and those who challenge them, the informed anti-globalization movement. Thus, we live with a very challenging paradox that governance is becoming an increasingly a multi-level, spatially dispersed activity, while representation, loyalty, and identity remain rooted in traditional ethnic, regional, and national communities. Hence, the shift from government to multi-layered governments, from national economic systems to economic globalization, is potentially unstable and capable of reversal and capable of engendering a fierce reaction, drawing on nostalgia, romanticized conceptions of political community, hostility to outsiders, refugees, and the search once again for a pure national state in the politics of Haider in Austria, Le Pen in France, and so on. But in my final couple of minutes, I want to suggest that this reaction itself is highly unstable, and if we're lucky, a relatively short and at best medium-term phenomena. And to understand why this is so, nationalism has to be disaggregated. As cultural nationalism, it is, and in all likelihood will remain, central to people's identity. But as political nationalism, the assertion of the exclusive political priority of national identity and the national interest, it alone cannot deliver many sought-after public goods without seeking accommodation to others. In this respect, I want to suggest only an international, or better still, cosmopolitan outlook can accommodate itself to the challenges of a more global era. Because unlike political nationalism, internationalism or cosmopolitanism registers and reflects the issues, questions, processes, and problems which infect and bind us all together, irrespective of where we're born or reside. So what is required is a shift from a club-driven and executive-led multilateralism, which is typically secretive and exclusionary, to a more transparent, accountable, and just form of global governance, a socially backed cosmopolitan multilateralism. And this has four simple requirements. One, that we recognize the increasing interconnectedness of political communities in diverse domains, social, economic, environmental, and so on. Without this, no getting off base one. Two, that we recognize the development, the essential development of an understanding of overlapping collective fortunes which require collective norms and solutions, not just globally, locally, nationally, regionally, and globally. Three, that we acknowledge the need for more decisions and more effective and accountable decisions at transnational levels, because without transnational solutions, many of the issues I started to talk about will not be resolved. And finally, that we extend and transform over time our existing multi-level, multi-layered polity, running from the local to the global, so that it adopts within its very modus operandi the principles of transparency, accountability, democracy, and social justice. Cosmopolitan multilateralism, finally, cannot be built on the American model of geopolitics, especially as conceived by the Republican right after 9/11. which constitutes, of course, a new form of global unilateralism. It seems to me the European social experiment, based on the model of social democratic values and the noble effort in collaborative governance, the EU, for all its faults, points the way forward. Yet even within the EU, we are in the gravest danger of generating a split between elite and mass politics and of the alienation of the popular will. Can this be avoided? Well, like nationalism, cosmopolitanism is a cultural and political project, but with one huge difference. It is better adapted and suited to our regional and global age. But we have to confess and admit that the arguments in support of this have yet to be won in the public sphere, and I think we lose them at our peril, because in my assessment, globalization without cosmopolitanism may well fail.
Thank you very much, and in a totally unplanned way, that connects very well to the next speaker, because in essence, we hadn't even planned the order of speaker before we came, but the references that David made to cosmopolitanism and an American model connects very well with what Mary Calder has been working on. She has recently authored a book on global civil society on sale outside, and she is about to write another, she's just written another book on global civil society as an answer to war. And so, Mary Calder.
Well, thank you very much. And David was quite right that what I'm going to say follows on very well from what he said. As both Meghnad and Tony said, this is the third time we've done this globalization debate, and the issues change. And I think what's become much more acute this time round is the issue of the politics of globalization. Last year and the year before, well, maybe not last year, because it was just after September the 11th, we were much more preoccupied with this economic and social speeding up of interconnectedness. Now we seem to have almost reached a crunch point where the political ways in which this process is going to be managed are being determined as we speak. And this is why I would really like to focus on the issue of American power and what this means for globalization. Is America, as Robert Kagan suggested in a recent article in Prospect magazine, and indeed as Bush himself suggests, both in his speeches and in his new national security doctrine, the new world policeman? Is it going to be a new global power devoted to ridding the world of terrorists and tyrants? This is what Bush claims he's trying to do. Is it the new global form of legitimate military power? Or is it, as the opponents would argue, the new empire? Is it the new hyperpower, as the French, former French Foreign Minister Hubert Védrine said? Is it now trying to use its spectacular military power to control the world's resources, especially oil, and to build new imperial areas? Well, my view, which I'm going to explain, is that neither of these positions is true. I do think that the term global unilateralist, which I think David used, but also has been used by Javier Solana, the Secretary General of the European Council, is much more appropriate as a word. I think the US has a tremendous power, military power, to destroy and disrupt emerging processes of global governance. But I'm not sure that it has the power to impose its will on territories, to do what Thomas Schelling, the famous strategist, called compellence. I'm not sure, Clausewitz said, the point of war, the aim of a war is to compel your opponent to your will. My argument is that's terribly difficult nowadays with military power. You can be destructive, but it's very, very difficult to achieve victory. Both the first two positions I put forward, the global policeman view and the empire view, really arise from an old-fashioned view of the world that derives from the Cold War and before. It is a world where territory is parceled up according to nation states, and where the boundaries are determined by military power. I think what's changed is twofold. One thing that's changed, and I won't describe it at length because that's exactly what both Tony Giddens and David Held talked about, is interconnectedness. The fact that societies are so interpenetrated that from the point of view of unilateral advantage, it doesn't actually make sense to impose empires and spheres of influence in a traditional way. But the other argument, which I want to focus on, because this is what I'm trying to think about, is the change in the nature of military power. I think that really, ever since the end of the Second World War, armaments have become so accurate and so destructive that the advantage of having superior technology or superior armaments has become much less. In a sense, all weapons, actually, nowadays, have the potential to be weapons of mass destruction. You don't even have to have weapons. If you look at what happened on September the 11th, that was the equivalent of a small nuclear weapon. And no weapons were actually used. And, of course, you can see, you can argue that in Rwanda, genocide was committed with machetes. And I think the real point is that nowadays, if you're fighting against an armed opponent, even if that opponent has lesser arms than you, it's extremely difficult to achieve a victory. What you can do is to create fear and insecurity, which often contributes to particular types, especially extremist politics. What you can do is to send a message or create a spectacle. If you think about September the 11th, it was directed at the Twin Towers. It was directed at the Pentagon. It was a message about globalization and about global military power. If you think about Bali, it was a message about modernity, secularity, about people dancing, people having fun in a global way. But what I'm really trying to say is that it's extremely difficult to capture territory in a traditional way. Let me give you two examples of typical types of wars. One type is what I call new wars. It's sometimes called network wars, where war is fought by networks of state and non-state actors, usually united around some kind of identity politics, whether it's religious fundamentalism or chauvinistic nationalism. These are wars in which the main violence is directed against civilians. The aim of these wars is to create an atmosphere in which people are forced to support extremist politics. Strategies like ethnic cleansing, genocide, widespread human rights violations, are designed to kill or expel enemies and to generate fear and hatred so that people mobilize around extremist politics. This is what happened, for example, in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And the legacy is the long-term nationalist support that we see today. Something similar is happening in the Israel-Palestine conflict today. Sharon's policy towards Palestine is very difficult to argue in rational military terms. From the point of view of compellence, is he going to ever achieve victory over Palestine? Why is he doing this? Because it simply perpetuates violence. It's only possible to explain rationally in terms of the way in which it sustains support for Sharon himself. And I think if we try to understand September the 11th and Bali, then really the effect, the aim, if there was an aim, we don't really know, was much the same. The aim was to create fear and insecurity, to create a kind of polarization that lends support to extremist causes. The point I really want to make here is, and here is a little disagreement with David about nationalism, the point I really want to make here is that these kinds of conflicts are very, very difficult to end and very, very difficult to contain. Because each bout of conflict strengthens the extremists and strengthens fear and hatred and tends to spread, creates more refugees and displaced persons, destroys physical infrastructure. So that's one type of war. The other type of war is what I call spectacle wars. That's the kind of war that the United States tends to fight or has done until recently, and that's long-distance wars fought from the air with aircraft and cruise missiles, high technology with a very low casualty rate on the American side. I call them spectacles because from the point of view of the Americans, they're imaginary. They're very, very real from the point of view of the victims, but from the point of view of the Americans, they don't really have to do anything. They don't have to risk their lives. They don't even have to pay taxes because taxes are actually being cut by Bush. They simply have to watch what's happening on television. And I think you have to understand this kind of war as a sort of degenerate form of what was happening during the Cold War. And there I agree with Tony about the legacy of the Cold War. You have to, during the Cold War, I think the best way to understand deterrence is a form of imaginary war. We acted as though we were at war for 50 years, and it structured governments in both the United States and the Soviet Union. It wasn't, maybe we were preventing, but we were also acting out. We were repeating the Second World War over and over again, and it had enormous implications for our society. And I think what you see among the people around Bush is that very many of them are the people who were also around Reagan. They come out of this Cold War world. They've been developing over the years a new type of war which will justify this kind of permanent war mentality. Now, my problem with this kind of war is precisely the difficulty of affecting the situation of the ground, of doing compellence. If you take the examples of Yugoslavia and Kosovo, in Yugoslavia, and by the way, I don't see the problem so much as collateral damage. I don't want to underestimate collateral damage because that's very terrible and civilians getting hurt is very terrible. But I want to stress that the real problem is that it means you can't control the situation on the ground. If you take Yugoslavia, actually what happened during the bombing was that Milosevic was able to use the bombing as a cover to accelerate ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, and there was nothing the NATO could do to stop that because it was in the air. Now, in the end, of course, it worked. Milosevic gave in, the Kosovars were liberated, but it has left a legacy of hatred and fear and nationalism, which again we saw in the last Serbian elections. Afghanistan, the Americans relied on the Northern Alliance on the ground. They did succeed in toppling the Taliban, but they have not succeeded in stabilizing the situation in the ground. They have not succeeded in capturing Al-Qaeda because they weren't prepared to put people on the ground. And they didn't, this is another issue, was that there was a terrible humanitarian crisis during this whole period, which they couldn't prevent because they weren't on the ground. And my fear is that Iraq could be even worse. Iraq could make Yugoslavia look like a picnic. That what Saddam Hussein will do when the bombing starts is to use his weapons of mass destruction, which he may or may not have, against his own people who are likely to topple him. So my argument is that spectacle war is not an answer to terrorists or tyrants. It may provoke them further. And maybe that's really the point. Not to provide an answer, but to provide a permanent war situation. So, to conclude, my fear is that US unilateralism will not control terrorism, nor will it be classic imperialism. It might even be better if it were classic imperialism. But what it will create is global anarchy, global violence, a kind of very nasty form of globalization where the negative networks cross borders. And I think the only alternative is one along the lines that David Held was suggesting. I think you could imagine the US becoming a global multilateralist, the US becoming part of a global set of rules. And we could only have a cosmopolitan set of rules of the kind David Held suggested if the US were part of it. An alternative, I think the only answer to network wars and extremist politics is to offer an alternative inclusive legitimacy based on law and based on a sense of global justice. But how are we to do this? How do we bring America into this fold? I mean, part of the answer is about the behavior of other states. A much stronger position needs to be held by, for example, the European Union on issues like the International Criminal Court, an alternative set of mechanisms, which may include military means, but I don't want to go into that now, for dealing with terrorists have to be developed. But I think part of the answer is developing an alternative from below. And that's where global civil society comes in. If you can cross networks in a negative way, you can cross boundaries in a negative way, you can also cross them in a positive way. We know that all kinds of diasporas have an influence on US policy. I think it's just incredibly important that we, people like us, should be trying to influence American public opinion. And not only us, let me say, make one final other suggestion. I wonder also about those global corporations that are the target of so much of the anti-globalization movement. Many of those global corporations are beginning to realize that a market requires stability, and stability may not be best achieved through a system of global unilateralism. So global companies as well as global civil society could turn out to be a kind of countervailing power that might support a multilateral set of rules. Above all, a notion that morality, as David put it, a new set of norms, has to offer an alternative way of organizing the world to classic geopolitics.
Thank you very much. I think of John Gray as a very wise owl. He has done every kind of philosophy. He's done political philosophy, moral philosophy, and he's been a very good sort of presence in the globalization debate, because he's always pointed out that some of the projects of globalization are completely utopian and will not happen. If they happen, the world would be a terrible place to live in. So if you think you've been depressed until now, wait till you hear John Gray.
Thank you very much, Meghnad. And what I have to say does follow on from the previous three speakers quite naturally, although it does give a slightly different view of what globalization is, the stage of globalization we're at, and what we can do about it. Because they're the three topics I want to address tonight. What globalization is, the first, the phase or the moment of globalization we now find ourselves in, and thirdly, what we can do about it. The first one thing I want to say about globalization follows, as to what it is, follows directly from what Tony Giddens said right at the start. Globalization isn't fundamentally to do with, it's certainly not identical with, the regime of free capital flows and global free trade and the intensification of the power of financial institutions that has occurred in the last 10 or 12 years. They're realities, but they're not, I think, the fundamental drivers of globalization. Like Tony Giddens, I think the fundamental driver is communications technology. I take the dating of globalization a bit further back than he did. I think it could be in the 1860s, not the 1960s, because in the 1860s, that was when underwater telegraph cables were laid down between the United States and Europe. And by the early 1870s, a financial crisis in Europe, in Austria, was already had a direct and almost instantaneous impact in New York. So one of the first thought I want to put to you is that what really drives globalization is a very complex process. It has many different aspects, some of them almost contradictory, and it has no, as it were, essence that we could agree on. But its most fundamental driver is technological. And for that reason, I believe it to be wholly unstoppable. Globalization, in this deep sense, cannot be stopped, cannot be reversed, can't even, I think, be significantly slowed down. It may not be desirable to do so. That's a secondary matter. It's impossible. And that's an important thing to understand, because some of the critics or opponents of globalization, among the anti-capitalists and others, want to reverse globalization in the sense that they want to relocalize economic activity, they want to go back to a simpler world of communities which are less interdependent. That's impossible. that's a utopia. And that, I think, is the first thing we need to understand. So what globalization really is, it seems to me, is a byproduct of scientific knowledge, of growing scientific knowledge. Now, earlier in human history, scientific knowledge wasn't unstoppable. It wasn't irreversible. There were periods in which great discoveries were made in China, earlier, and in ancient Greece, and weren't followed up, died out, were lost for generations, centuries, even millennia. So in earlier periods of human history, science hasn't been, the growth of scientific knowledge hasn't been an unstoppable, irreversible, self-reinforcing process. Now it is. Even if there were some kind of catastrophe which wiped out most of the human species, it seems to me clear that most scientific knowledge would not be lost, and therefore the growth of scientific knowledge would continue, and for that reason, so would globalization. So one key thing to understand is it's nonsense to think that it can be reversed or stopped or, as it were, abolished or prohibited. It's going to go on in this fundamental sense, whatever else happens. But that's not to say, and here's my second point, where we are now, that's not to say that the present global regime will last forever. After all, it's only been with us for about 12 years since the Soviet collapse, the regime of free capital markets, global free trade. And if you look back in the 20th century, similar regimes, and in the 19th century, similar regimes collapsed as a result, basically, of war. And I think myself that it's not only possible, but even likely by now, that the present global regime may break apart in a similar way. That's to say, I think that the present globalization, contrary to some of its critics, is extremely fragile, and that it already shows many signs of unraveling. And here's a rather interesting thought, which is my second thought to put to you. My first thought was globalization in this technological sense, in the sense in which it's a byproduct of scientific knowledge, is unstoppable. My second thought is that deep globalization, that irreversible process of globalization actually works to undermine and break down globalization as commonly conceived, that's to say, the current global economic regime. It's fraying at the edges, it's breaking apart, partly because of war. And I want to say something then about war in this regard. I think one thing which is forgotten is that the last big war of the 20th century was in part a resource war. The last big war of the 20th century, the Gulf War, was at least partly, if not mainly, about control of oil supplies. The next big war, the first big war of the 21st century, may well also be partly, and I think will be partly, a resource war. And there's a truth in this which I think we've got to understand if we're to be sober and prudent about the risks we face. Globalization, in one of its aspects, as I've mentioned earlier, is just a byproduct of scientific knowledge. A simpler way of putting that is that globalization is embodied in worldwide industrialization. And as the whole world industrializes, the need for scarce natural resources increases and intensifies, and competition to control them increases and intensifies. Now, of course, if there really were a global free market, which worked in the way that economic models say it should work, then this would be a self-adjusting process. That's to say, prices would go up as a result of prices going up. Companies would find alternative sources of energy and natural resources. Prices would then fall. In other words, you would have a technological substitution. You would have further, more efficient forms of extraction. That would be true if really the world were a global free market. It isn't. What it is a structure in which power and inequality interact with urgent human needs. And in that kind of structure, states will not wait for free markets to work, even if they do in the long run. I doubt that, but even if they do in the long run, states won't wait. They'll act to seize control of resources if they believe those resources are threatened. So one of the ways, I think, in which the deep technological process of globalization and worldwide industrialization breaks up or threatens or even destroys the current global economic regime is that it pushes us closer to the limits of growth, which haven't gone away. The limits of growth have returned as resource wars. I think resource wars are real. I think there have already been resource wars. I think there are likely to be future resource wars. And if we're not careful and wise, much of this century might be punctuated by further resource wars. What can we do about it? Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is to really scrap the mode of thinking that prevailed in much of the period of globalization in the 90s. During the 90s, there was a view of the kind of institutions and policies appropriate to globalization, which essentially was a one-model view. People from transnational institutions, notably the IMF, but also to some degree others, arrived in countries as different as Russia, Argentina, Nigeria, and Indonesia with, miraculously, exactly the same solutions to completely different problems. They arrived with a single model in their briefcases and tried to implement it. Not surprisingly, the model melted down in each of these cases in different ways.
How did the countries melt it down? The models arrived.
That's unfortunately true. Unfortunately, the model hasn't melted down yet. I wish it would. The cost of the model was the meltdowns in the countries. And I don't think it's true, as defenders of the model say, well, it would have ended. We've heard that, I suppose, from radical Marxists about the Soviet Union or radical Maoists about Maoist China. It's a pity there isn't a radical Nazi around who can say, well, you know, if we'd really been more consistent about this, it would have worked. I don't think that's true. I think the model was basically at fault. It was basically at fault in its simplicity, its crudity, and its neglect of the different histories and current needs and values of these different countries. So the beginning, I think, the starting point of avoiding the risks that are clear and urgent is to recognize that there is no single sustainable model of human progress in the age of globalization. Not even the European social model, not the American model, not the Chinese market reform, not the Russian model, which is now emerging. All of these models may be appropriate in particular contexts. None of them can be universal. I have myself some doubts or some skepticism about whether Islamic banking can be really made viable, but I can say one thing about it. It's no more fantastic or unrealistic than the crackpot schemes which the IMF implemented and imposed in many parts of the world. Let different countries try different models. Let them not be forced into adopting a single model. My final remark, I think the key, my third and final thought is really that the key to living, to making the best of globalization is not really on thinking how to implement a single model throughout the world. It's not even how to develop or strengthen institutions of global governance. That's one view, it's an important view, but it's not my view. The key, I think, we face is how to adjust our thinking and our institutions so that regimes and cultures which will remain different however rapidly globalization advances can learn to coexist in peace together. The chief threat facing us today is the threat of war. We need to look at environmental policy, we need to look at energy policy, we need to look at means whereby we can avoid the limits of growth reappearing as resource wars. But we also need to look back at history and recognize that regimes of tolerance, regimes of toleration and peaceful coexistence are not exclusively Western, they're not exclusively liberal, and they're not even exclusively modern. Buddhist India, the Ottoman Empire, the medieval Moorish kingdoms in Spain, these were all regimes which in one way or another practiced forms of coexistence and toleration. So I think what we really need to be thinking about is a less unified world culturally and politically, one which can cope with ecological problems which are genuinely global, but which does not attempt to impose any model, be it an American free market model, the European social democratic model, or some third model globally. I really think that we should think in a different way than we thought about globalization so far, if we're to avoid what would be almost the worst thing I can imagine, which is a rerun of the 20th century and the 21st.
Thank you very much. Well, there you have it.
Meg-nag.
Yeah.
Can I tell a joke about the Baroque use of technology to which Mary referred? It's only a short one. When the American astronauts went into space, they found that ballpoint pens wouldn't work in conditions of weightlessness, so they spent $50 million on inventing a ballpoint pen that would work when you were weightless. In the meantime, the Russians used a pencil.
Okay. Question time. And are there microphones running around? One there, one there. Upstairs, other microphones? One there, one over here somewhere. Okay, good. Now, I want to see some hands up. Gentleman there, and then the person here, up in the fifth or sixth row. No, have him be near him because he will be the next person. And then upstairs, can I see some hands upstairs? No hands upstairs. Okay. First of all, keep your questions short. Make them questions, not statements, and everything starts. Does the panel agree that? If you start anywhere else, I'll shut you up. Gentleman there. Yeah, your question.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I just want to ask John Gray a question about resource wars. Ask him one question? Sorry.
Yeah.
Firstly, could you indicate other examples of resource wars other than the Gulf War? But also, capitalism has become less resource intensive. To make silicon, you just need sand. Other than oil, what were the other strategic resources that you think people are going to be fighting about?
Okay, good. Where's the mic in? Come on, question.
I have two questions. Actually, form one.
First, one question.
Yeah, I'll say it. I'm curious exactly what governance refers to, and how that relates to the issue of cosmopolitanism when we're looking towards a future of difference.
Okay. Gentleman there. And on this side, who's got a hand up? The gentleman there who always asks questions, comes to every public lecture. No. The gentleman there.
This is a question for John Gray. This idea of alternative source of energy resources like natural, what would you suggest to those countries that base their economies on producing oil? And is this just another American, European example of solving problems without taking care of other countries' economies?
Thank you. Over there in white hair. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
During the first initial phase of the globalization debate, there seemed to be some consensus that the traditional concepts of left and right were going to be blurred. And nonetheless, I hear evocations of these terms again, as recently as last week by the ex-prime minister of Denmark. What will be the status do the panelists think about left-right?
Okay. Gentlemen there. Somebody in the middle. Person in the middle there. Yeah. Okay, next. Yeah. After that, yeah.
I would like to expand on Professor...
Question.
Yeah.
What's your question?
Well, the question is, how can we have a globalized process or in view of the asymmetry which has been created by the fact that the whole process has been hijacked by the market forces lately? Now, Professor Giddens...
No, that's a good question. Gentlemen there. Yeah.
About the different models. Do different models rule out a worldwide accountability?
does the panel agree that, in view of the fact that U.S. has no monopoly on narrow self-interest in the current world environment, and that there's still no shortage of ethnic, linguistic, and religious nationalism, that a sudden outbreak of cosmopolitanism seems rather unlikely at the moment? So while I may agree with Professor Held, I'm not entirely convinced that this will come to pass. So in short, it sounds good, but how likely is it?
About cosmopolitanism, what institution can we think of to support this idea or values of cosmopolitanism in order to bring about more equal global society?
Hello. Does the panel agree with John Gray's view of resource wars? Why or why not? And I would remind people that without the answer to why or why not, you get a satisfactory pass at LSE.
Okay. Thank you very much. Where's the mic now? On this side. Is there a question this side? The gentleman at the back there. And then the person over there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a question for Professor John Gray about the feasibility of the Marxist model in the context of globalization. Thank you.
Thank you. Person there.
Does the panel think that the models of democracy as exemplified in the UK and the US, if globalized, could solve problems such as environmental degradation and global social injustice?
Okay. The person at the very back. Not many women are asking questions. I'm worried about this.
There's one.
Yeah.
A question to Mary is to say that the global theater commands for U.S. Army, does it have any impact on globalization, or is there any correlation?
The global what?
The Army, U.S. Army theater commands. You know, you have Western theater command, Central theater command.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. The lady there.
There's one right at the back there.
No. Somebody's got a mic. Yeah. we got the mic is gone. Well, you know, a gender-biased mic. What do you expect? okay. Who's got a hand up there? On this side. Okay. The lady with the very, very back. No. Is there a mic for her? Okay. Well, shout.
Words of wisdom to him in one sentence.
What? If Osama bin Laden was here, what would be the panel's words of wisdom?
Yes, yes.
Oh, well, good. okay, where's the mic now? Okay, the gentleman here. Yeah. And then the lady over there, yeah. Okay, come on.
Is population growth a problem for globalization?
Good. Next.
I was wondering if the panel would agree if the UN is a viable means of global governance.
Very good. We're getting somewhere.
Stop.
Okay, that's it. I have had a humanitarian appeal from the panel that there were too many questions. Okay, I'm now going to go in reverse order. John Gray first.
Okay, I'll try and answer some of the questions that I was asked directly to me or to the panel more generally. Are there really resource wars? It's obvious that there are, and it's not an accident that they concern oil. If someone says, well, only oil, that's like saying only the air we breathe, because oil is the absolute precondition of industrial societies as we know them today. It may be the case that in 20 or 30 or 50 or 60 years, we have a hydrogen economy or something. In fact, I think it's very likely myself. I'm optimistic about technology over that kind of range. I'm not a pessimist about that possibility. But in the meantime, what we can see quite clearly is that many of the policies and conflicts in the world are 19th century geopolitical struggles. We may find this lamentable. We should not deny it or close our eyes to it. It seems to me to be just quite plainly a fact. In other contexts, of course, I think resources are also important. Water has been a factor in conflicts in the Middle East. It was a factor in the Rwanda catastrophe. Fresh water is not is decreasingly plentiful in the world, and I've little doubt that its role in conflicts will increase unless we're smart and intelligent and far seeing. So I think the idea that capitalism has cut loose from natural resources has become weightless. It's just a fantasy. It's not supported by the history of the last 10 or 15 years. It won't be supported very likely by events over the next year or two. It may be true in the long run, and I think it will be true in the long run, that we'll come up with alternatives to oil. But as I mentioned in my remarks, in the shorter run, urgent human needs will drive policy. The short run is human history. The short run is the world we actually live in. The long run is a fantasy. As Keynes said, that's when we're all dead. I only try to answer one other question, which is about Marxism. Does Marxism, could there be viable Marxist models? Well, there have been semi-viable Marxist models which have achieved something. I mean, until the, in Cuba, for example, Castro's Cuba, until the Soviet collapse, diminished resources that were accessible. I think it was true that levels of education and health were higher than in many other developing countries. But I have an objection to the Marxist model more generally, which is similar to the objection I have to the neoliberal model, which is although it has had different forms in different countries, it is essentially a one-model theory. That's to say what it is essentially a theory which says that at the end of the day, whatever that means or whenever that happens, the whole world will be united in a single economic system, having the same features. Cultural and religious differences will have, if not disappeared, become politically marginal. They'll have kind of faded away, or they'll no longer at least be a source of conflict. I don't think that's on the cards. So I, without while recognizing that some Marxist regimes have had significant achievements, I can't endorse a Marxist alternative to current globalization, because a global Marxist alternative to the current system of neoliberal globalization would also be a one-model-fits-all, a one-size-fits-all solution. And that's exactly the opposite, it seems to me, of what we need in many, many contexts.
Mary.
Well, I don't agree with John about resource wars. And in fact, this is one of my interests, is the role of oil in contemporary conflicts. I think oil was absolutely critical strategic resource in the wars of the 20th century. And if you read a book like Daniel Yergin's The Prize, you'll see how the sides in the two world wars were determined to control the sources of oil and were afraid of a hostile power denying them access. But I think precisely for all the reasons I gave about the changing nature of warfare, this is no longer the central problem, because the kinds of wars we face are wars, network wars, new wars, wars of instability, which certainly will affect oil supplies in particular areas, but not in a global sense. I think oil affects these conflicts in two ways. One is that at a local level, sometimes control of oil is important as a way of financing your war effort, not as a strategic resource. And this is a long argument, it affects the character of states, which I could talk about at length, but I'm not going to. If you look at the Gulf War, it seems to me that it's much better to understand oil as a legitimation of a conflict which had much more to do with the post-Cold War role of the United States and its position in the global order than it had to do with direct control of oil. In fact, it was jolly bad for controlling oil, because look what happened. And the same might be true of the current war in Iraq. If America does succeed in occupying Iraq, we'll have a fall in the oil prices. A lot of other sources of oil in the Caucasus, Central Asia, in Africa, which many oil companies have invested a lot, will become much less profitable. So I don't agree with, I think oil's legitimation, old-fashioned, it's all part of appearing to do old-fashioned geopolitics, which is no longer relevant. Couple of other points. Well, I won't answer cosmopolitanism and models of democracy because I'll leave them to David, and we don't have time, and so I won't answer them. The American commands, do they... I've forgotten the question about the American commands. Do they contribute to globalization? Well, again, if you're talking about political globalization, my point would be that, no, they don't. They, as unilateral American commands, they don't contribute to globalization, but insofar as they could potentially be part of a multilateral process, which is designed towards keeping the peace rather than unilateral American actions, then it could contribute to the kind of multilateral rules that David and I were talking about. Just one last thing. What would I do if what would I say to Osama bin Laden if he was here in the room? I would say, I arrest you. I would say, I arrest you as a citizen of the world, and I would demand that the UN set up an ad hoc criminal court to try him. I don't know where I'd put him, whether we've got a room in the LSE to keep him until we've succeeded, but I would just say, I arrest you. I wouldn't try and persuade him. I don't think he's persuadable. I would arrest him, and I would be delighted to arrest him.
Salaam alaikum. What would you say?
Well, to be very brief, great questions. Thank you, audience. Two, can't answer them all. Three, to Osama, if he were here, I'd say three alternative different things. One is crime against humanity, or I'd say, in four words, a bit more, sanctity of life, or I'd say social justice, not geopolitics, because what we have in him, Al-Qaeda, is another form of sectarian geopolitical struggle. On the wider set of questions that I was asked, let me just pick up a few. Governance. By governance, I simply mean diverse forms of rulemaking, which are no longer just monopolized by states. They're now being made by public and private agencies, locally, nationally, regionally, globally. We live in already a world of multi-layered, highly complex forms of rulemaking, not all of which are located and connected any longer with coercive power or political power as traditionally understood. Secondly, I would say, contra John Gray, although I was enormously appreciative of his elegant remarks, that unless we have new forms of collective institutions which are democratic and justly oriented in their form and structure, then traditional forms of sorting out collective problems will rule. And those traditional forms are the imposition of hegemonic powers, rogue states, not just rogue states like Iraq, I'm thinking of rogue hegemonic powers like the current United States government. Secondly, geopolitics will rule and collective problems will be solved by states struggling to impose themselves on particular collective outcomes, or markets will rule as they currently largely do. The reason for new collective democratic and cosmopolitan institutions is to limit and delimit the working out of those forms of power. Are these necessarily in contradiction to difference and diversity? Not at all, because they depend for their development and articulation on principles that acknowledge difference and diversity at their heart, the principle of equal liberty, of social determination, of self-determination, and of social justice. These are the only principles we have for creating institutions that allow people to explore their differences in a framework of collective decision-making, which is specific, collectively oriented, and oriented to democratic and justice issues. This is the bedrock of diversity and difference, not its contradiction, in my view. Does left and right still matter? Absolutely. But not just in the traditional terms that we understand in the state-based again, because unless we generate new resources to deal with those who are the poorest, most vulnerable, not just, of course, the 3,000 people who died on 9/11, but the 50,000 who die every day of poverty, malnutrition, and so on. Unless we generate new resources at an international level, these forms of gross inequality will not be addressed. So we need new mechanisms, internationally based mechanisms, I believe, such as the Tobin tax, but not just the Tobin tax, to address these sorts of issues. Left-right still matters because social justice still matters. Finally, cosmopolitanism, is that just for the there and then or the here and now? Cosmopolitanism is already part of our world. Why is it part of our world? Because it's been conceived and embedded in law against the backdrop of the gravest forms of human emergency. You think of the Holocaust and the impact of the Holocaust. The Holocaust in the post-1945 world gave rise to new multilateral institutions, the UN Charter, which placed cosmopolitan values at its center, from changes in the law of war to human rights law, right the way through to the ICC. These are already laying down and embedding aspects of cosmopolitan values. The problem is not that. The problem is the disjuncture between those principles and values and many of the geopolitical institutions that still resolve, filter, and determine most collective outcomes. We have cosmopolitan values, but they're spliced together with the geopolitical settlement of 1945. So what we need is a new phase of cosmopolitan institution building. Of course, this is not just for tomorrow or the next day. This is a long-term project, and in my view, it is now no more utopian, no more remarkable, no more unimaginable, no more unattainable than the idea of the modern state was when it was first promulgated by Hobbes, Baudin, and others. Thank you.
Last but not least.
As director of the institution, I'm sure Magdalena will say this again at the very end, but thanks to everyone for coming here, and thanks to my colleagues for participating on the panel. Dave and I got an email after this event was set up from someone who said, why you just got an in-house event, you know, where people tend to agree with one another. The reason was that it's worked well in previous years and we wanted to repeat it, but I would stress there are many other events going on. So tomorrow there is another globalization lecture given by Naomi Klein. And David also has this brilliant looking series next term on American power in the 21st century. So there are many other aspects of these ideas being discussed elsewhere in the LSE. Let me just comment quickly on a couple of questions. The question on left and right seemed to be directed a bit to me. Well, Tony Blair and Gerhard Schroeder were driving a car, you see, and they come to this crossroads. And the Gerhard Schroeder says, which way shall I go? And Tony Blair says, indicate left and turn right. But this is not what I think, because I think left and right manifestly still count for a lot in the world. I mean, you have to see, I think, that the old idea of the left has changed because no one knows any alternative to a decent market economy. There is no known centralized economy which would work. So the old idea of some people on the left has more or less disappeared. But I hope you can see that the advent of the discourse of globalization has produced a new polarization of politics around right and left. On the one hand, you have the rise of a new far right across the world. The new far right speaks the discourse of globalization. It objects to the uncertainties. It objects to what it sees as the attack on national identity. It actually has the corporations as its enemy. It is protectionist. Some of these things are shared, as it were, by the new far left on the fringes of the anti-globalization movement. They're obviously very different in other ways, but the discourse of globalization has produced a kind of new resonance to the polarization of left and right. And I think David was quite right in saying if anyone who stands on the left, the difference is social justice. That is, we want a more just world. I believe you can produce a more just world, and anyone who stands left or center, I think, believes that you need agency to do that. You can't just leave it to the market. You need active, well-disposed governments to achieve such a world, as well as civil society agencies and so on. There was a question on markets, which I'll skip because we're coming to the end, but I feel I must mention this question because at least one person took the trouble to write down a question. The question was a bit like the left and right one. It's what is the mandate of leftist intellectuals in the globalization process, who are reaping the fruits of globalization in the West in exchange for criticizing globalization
and its unjust distributive consequences. Well, I mean, we sit here as I think some of those intellectuals, and we don't have a mandate. I don't think anyone pretends, and I take it most people in, if you want to call it the anti-globalization movement, don't think they have a mandate. They don't. There is only one way to get a mandate, and that's through democratic process, in my opinion. So that I think you should not pretend, nor should the anti-globalization movement pretend, that it stands for the interests of the rest of humanity. But what it should stand for, and what this debate should stand for, is putting issues on the agenda. And I think the leftist intellectuals in the anti-globalization movement have done that. They may have done things that some of us might object to, but they put these things on the agenda. And I hope the LSE puts these things on the agenda. So I think we do have a mandate. What we do have a mandate to do is to raise issues, to look at them, to discuss their implications, and to see what the world might do about them. We don't have a mandate to implement, but the role of intellectuals is to bring things into public debate, and I hope this public debate is part of that process. Finally, I think you don't have to look very far for the cosmopolitan principle. You don't have to see cosmopolitan principle just a utopian one. The LSE, I think, enshrines it. As I mentioned right at the very beginning, we have 150 nations represented, the LSE community. We believe we have an obligation to discuss issues in a direct way, free from violence, and we believe that we're contributing to the emergence of a global cosmopolitan community. The LSE enshrines it, and the LSE should contribute to it. Thank you.
Thank you for all the speakers. Thank you for coming. One more announcement. On Thursday, in the Global Civil Society series, Professor Helmut Anhaer is going to talk about the organizational forms of global civil society. Remember, you are the global elite. You're going to run globalization and anti-globalization. You will have to get it right, not us. Thank you.